Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Jason Hardy, whose new book is The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Jason Hardy is definitely a New Orleans writer to watch. He's an FBI agent now, but here's some of his backstory. He's a hometown native, went to Jesuit High School, and has an MFA from Louisiana State University. He's been a high school English teacher, a bartender, a waiter, sold watches at JCPenney, and then he turned to public service. He chronicles that experience in a new book, The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Jason Hardy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
So tell us how you got into the line of probation and parole work.
To be honest with you, I got into it by accident. As you just said, I kind of bounced around careers in my 20s. I taught for a few years. I worked in the service industry. I did some retail work. And, you know, I was 29, and I just was kind of looking to make a change. And I was doing some reading on the mass incarceration problem in America. And I read the book, The New Jim Crow, which I know changed a lot of people's thinking about how the law enforcement system worked. And it just seemed like something that I really wanted to get involved in. And I looked at a lot of different law enforcement jobs that were out there. And the only one that was hiring at the time was this probation and parole job. And the job description was pretty vague. It was along the lines of, if you want to change people's lives, if you are willing to work for low pay and long hours, we're your man. So going on that alone, I was a little bit afraid of what I was getting myself into, but I just was ready to make a change. And like I said, it was a way into the justice system at a time when that was kind of the only job out there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about your training, which included firearms training and studying obscure statutes like theft of an alligator.
That's right.
I did want to know more about that.
So if you steal, let's say, a normal good that's worth $5,000, the penalty is not as severe as if you steal an alligator that's worth $5,000. So alligators, crawfish, kind of our local premium goods are protected by the law in kind of an extra way. So
I'm very glad to know that. Thank you. Now, I want you to read that description of your very first day at work, because you're showing up, you're new on the job, you're in this new environment, and you set up the story so beautifully.
Thank you. So this is fresh out of the academy, first day on the job. I showed up early for my first day as a fully commissioned PO and walked the halls in the new boots I'd bought myself as a graduation present. The carpet at the New Orleans district was balding. The ceiling was flecked with mold. It was exactly the kind of place where I'd always imagined social justice was made. Around 9 o'clock, Dan, the regional manager, took hold of me. Later in the day, I would learn that the staff referred to him exclusively as Dan, the regional manager. He was short and trim, with a big chin that bobbed as he shook hands, and a black mustache carved thin. He wore a constant nervous smile, as if he'd gotten good news, but was holding off on believing until he saw the proof. "You can't imagine how happy people are going to be to see you," he said. The New Orleans district was allotted 45 positions, but lately there had been funding for only 40. Pay was frozen, benefits were getting more expensive by the year, and caseloads were the highest they'd ever been. A fresh body showed the troops that the state hadn't forgotten about little old P&P. It was an unconventional welcome speech, nothing like the academy director's, but I didn't have time to parse it. We'd arrived at my office. There was my name on the door. The name above mine was Charles Lewis. He looked to be about 40, but was as fit and lean as a high school distance runner. He had a heavy beard and a hometown ball cap pulled low across his brow. I would learn later that Charles was one of only 10 African-American POs at the New Orleans district, but if he was put off by the news that the bosses had hired another white person, He didn't let it show. New guy, Dan the regional manager said by way of introduction, and he clapped me once on the shoulder and continued down the hall. Good timing, Charles said. We're just getting started. This is Vincent. He pointed at the person seated across the desk from him, a man about 20 or 21, with a Colt 45 tattooed laterally across his neck. Vincent's chair had cracks in the two rear legs and yellow foam spilling from the ripped cushion. Vincent pressed the balls of his feet to the carpet and eased the chair back into the wall. Anyway, he told Charles, I'm glad you locked me up. Another week at the pace I was going, and I would have been fish food. That's good to hear, Charles said. You didn't seem all that glad at the time. At the time, I was a junkie. Now I'm clean. It was destiny, you finding me when you did. Destiny, huh? It was all a lot more candid than I'd expected. 30 seconds in, and they were already broaching the mysteries of the universe. They wouldn't call it the Second Chance Club, Vincent said, lifting his hands to Providence, if they didn't expect you to screw up.
Whoa. You seem to really luck into your office mate with Charles Lewis, who seems so street smart and savvy and generous with his knowledge.
He was. Yeah, he's really a terrific guy. I actually had lunch with him about a week ago to get caught up. But he's been doing this job for over 20 years now and knows every trick of the trade and can do more with a facial expression to change somebody's attitude than most of us can do with an hour-long conversation. So he's a true pro.
And he gave you some interesting ways to think about this work. Disaster prevention, harm reduction.
Yes. So his attitude was to do the best you can with the tools they give you. And essentially what that means is that a lot of the folks that were coming to us had been in trouble for a long time. And mm-hmm. we dealt with a lot of different kinds of trouble. But I learned pretty quickly that it wasn't going to be as simple as people come through the door, you give them a pep talk, maybe you refer them to a local agency, and then life gets back on track. These were folks with pretty serious problems to deal with. And the POs who seemed to do the best on the job were people who, like I said, worked in that sort of disaster prevention mindset where I can't fix every problem, but if I can kind of put out the biggest fires, then I'll have done my job.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the size of your caseload and the people you chose for this book, because you chose some really interesting characters, some of them very endearing.
Sure. So most of the time I had about 220 people on my caseload. It got as high as about 245 and as low as maybe 190, but 220 was about the average. That number is a little misleading. About 35 to 40 were in what we called warrant status, which basically meant that they'd vanished and we didn't know where they were. You'd have another 15 or 20 that were in kind of an administrative status, which generally meant that they were either sick or injured and were more or less bedbound, and so there mm-hmm. wasn't much we could do with them. So that left, 140 to 150 that were, quote unquote, on the streets. And one of the interesting things about probation and parole is that the officer and the department have a lot of discretion in how much time and energy they put into each individual person. So for the book, I wanted to talk about people that I got to know well just because I could provide more information about them. But of the 220, there were probably 45 total that I saw for more than 30 minutes a month. Probably 80 people on my caseload I saw only twice a year. So of the 45 to 50 I knew well, I tried to pick seven where there were kind of two different ways that things could have gone for them. Mm-hmm. These were all people that I saw potential in, and they were also people who were up against a lot. And so I thought an interesting way to structure this was just to look at how are these folks going to turn out. And, one of the big questions that I asked myself throughout, and I'm still asking now, is what could we have done better to help them?
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about, say, Sheila.
Sure. Well, Sheila was really up against a lot. Sheila was 18 when she came on my caseload. She was either the youngest or the second youngest person I had at the time. She grew up in the 7th Ward, which is one of the tougher neighborhoods in New Orleans. Her mother had been battling a crack addiction for 20 and 25 years. They lived together in this really, really kind of run-down shotgun double. And Sheila had dropped out of school in the 11th grade. And she was dating a drug dealer. And in fact, she was on probation because she had flushed her drug dealer's drugs down the toilet when the police showed up at the house to serve a search warrant there. So she was actually on probation for obstruction of justice, of all things, which is not a charge we saw a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, despite all those obstacles, she just had this kind of amazing life force. She was just this effervescent person. And a lot of times what you were looking for as a PO was that spark where you could say, maybe you've made some bad decisions, maybe some tough things have happened to you, but we see that light in you and we want to kind of try to help you find another way.
And talk a little bit about a hardhead.
Hardhead, sure. well, there were actually several hardheads, but the one that I spoke about in this book was a guy who, he was actually from Mississippi originally. He was a Vietnam vet, and he kind of found his way to New Orleans sometime after the war. And he would tell you, you know, I came to New Orleans to get high, mm-hmm. and I did it for 40-odd years. And he would have these bouts of, you know, short bouts of sobriety, long bouts of homelessness. And part of what was so interesting about him was every time he would go to get clean, he really believed that this was going to be the time. And he put in the effort and he worked the program with so much energy and conviction. And then as soon as he would get out of a program, he would relapse.
He had such hope.
He did. He did. Yeah. And without giving too much away, things I think turned out all right for him in the end, but it was a long struggle.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Jason Hardy, whose new book is The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. Now, this is not the New Orleans you grew up in. You're working in parts of the city I dare say you've never visited.
That's true.
Before.
I grew up in Metairie. I had no experience in Central City or Holly Grove or any places like that. So it was a new experience to me for sure.
And in many cases, you're making a home visit.
Right.
To check on these parolees or probationers.
That's right.
So talk about what that felt like to enter into someone's home.
Well, I think the biggest surprise was that it didn't seem all that strange to most of the folks I was dealing with. And the reason was that pretty much every one of them had been involved in the criminal justice system for a while. So having someone in law enforcement, in particular government in general, coming by the house was kind of old hat to a lot of these people. And so, you know, if I showed up nervous, a lot of times they would be the one to take the edge off. You know, mm-hmm. like I've been having a PO come by forever. And 99.9% of the visits were essentially just conversations. You know, you'd walk in. Of course, part of the job was to make sure there was nothing illegal inside, nothing dangerous, nobody inside was hurt. But a lot of it was really going to someone's house to try to get to know them better. And the hope was that, the better you knew them, the more that you could help.
Mm-hmm. And you hung in there for 4 years doing this.
A little more than 4 years, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think a lot of POs will say this, that they're sort of, it takes about 2 years to learn the job and then another two to get burned out. And I have worlds of respect for people who've done 18 or 20 years in this work, because it really can take its toll on you.
But at its core, I mean, at rock bottom, when it's done well, perhaps, or done right, it is very human work. It is storytelling. It is concern for another person. So talk a little bit about that. We talked briefly about how recently in the New York Times there was this article about algorithms that are predicting the rate of, you know, recidivism or risk for prisoners. And one of the parolees said, "Where's my human interaction? Who's going to listen to my story?" Didn't you feel that was an important part of your job when you could make the time?
Oh, absolutely. And really, I think that's what keeps people in it, are those moments of human connection where you're hearing someone's story and you actually have the resources to kind of help them get what they need to turn their life around. And, you know, one of the recurring themes in this book is that very often we could hear a problem, we could sympathize with a problem, but we just weren't funded adequately to really help a problem. You know, one example that comes up a lot is if you would develop enough trust with someone, he might come up to you and say, "Hey, look, I relapsed yesterday and I need to get into detox. But at the time I was at probation and parole," and I'm happy to say things are a little better now, "but there were only 5 or 6 detox beds in the whole city for people who didn't have insurance." So generally detox was code for jail. Mm-hmm. You know, so if someone came to you and said they need a detox, what they were really saying was, "I need you to arrest me and take me to OPP. So a lot of times, you know, you'd have that breakthrough in conversation, but you weren't actually equipped to help the person. And going to the question of algorithms, this is something that's been a part of a lot of discussions in criminal justice reform. Given that resources are limited, especially in this community supervision wing, I think the algorithms are supposed to help you direct your resources kind of to the neediest people, but sometimes they tell a different story than the human interaction. And I think in the article you're referring to, that was someone where he felt like if he could just get in front of somebody who could hear his story, then he could really get his needs met. But this computer just wasn't going to really tell you who he was.
Mm-hmm. You described that drive to just take somebody to jail to detox with Charles. And that's just kind of harrowing.
It is, yes. This is the old OPP. The new one obviously is very different, but the OPP was a really rough place. And again, I'd never been inside myself, but all kinds were in there. There's this kind of tank that people are put in when they first go in, and it could be everything from a violent offender to somebody who got too drunk on Bourbon Street to somebody who is about to go through detox. And these are people who can be in a really desperate state. So the first time I went in there, it was a wake-up call for sure.
So talk about the people you worked with. What were they like besides Charles? Tell us about some of the others, like Beth, whom I really liked. I like Beth going, who doesn't want to see puppies?
Well, it was an interesting collection of people. So Charles, I guess, would be on the side of the ledger who was, he was more of a sit down with you, give you a pep talk, I guess a more conventionally liberal type guy. Beth was a more conservative type. She would more get in your face and tell you, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And part of what made it such an interesting place to work was that everybody had the same goal, which was to help the people in our caseloads get work, get clean, get housing, get their lives in order. But people kind of just took different approaches. And sometimes it came down to how you were raised, you know. Sometimes it came down to your own experience. A lot of people could say, hey, when I was at my worst point in my life, I needed somebody to be tough on me, mm-hmm. you know. And then other people would say, when I was at my low point, I needed a break. And so a lot of times personal experiences would really play into kind of how you supervised your caseload. But one of the real astonishing things about this job was that almost without fail, everyone I worked with there really believed in the work and really cared about the work. And even though people had different perspectives about it, as I said, the end goal was the same, which was to help people get back on their feet.
Right. So you don't leave readers wanting for ideas for things that will help. So talk about some of the reforms that you think are urgent and important.
Well, I'm happy to say that some of them are already underway. One of the things that I came back to a lot, and this is to the credit of the state, in late 2015, early 2016, when they were starting to change how they thought about probation and parole, they sent a lot of us to various conferences where we could kind of learn about, you know, what are the latest big ideas? What are some things that are working better in other parts of the country? And one kind of simple idea is just to try to reduce caseloads by making sentences shorter. And so when I was there, most people were on probation for at least 5 years. Many people were on parole for 10 or more.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, if you can take a 5-year probation and compress it into somewhere between 1 and 2 years, obviously that frees up a lot of the money you were spending over 5 years to do something in a year or a year and a half that's a lot more intensive. And one of the programs that I really love and believe in is Drug Court. And this is a program where instead of just having a PO stop by once a month to try to give somebody a pep talk, you know, the offender actually has a full slate of professionals that are there to help them. So treatment counselors, psychiatrists if they need it. And once a week, they get in front of a judge and get to report on their progress. You know, and if things are going well, they get a commendation from the judge. If they need a sanction, the judge can hand that down. But I think simply by shortening sentences and making probation kind of more intensive, but for a shorter amount of time, we can just get much better results.
And ease that transition.
For sure. And I mean, that's really the key thing, especially for the parolees who are people just coming out of jail. What they really need when they hit the streets is just an infusion of resources. And, you know, if you cut somebody out on parole and then going back to algorithms, the algorithm tells you you need to see this guy twice a year, you're really not providing him with any kind of structure to get his life back in order.
Right.
If he gets out of jail and you don't see him for 6 months, what have you really done?
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Jason Hardy, whose new book is The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. One of the things you try to avoid as a PO is parole revocation.
Yes.
And that's a failure, right?
Yes. And I think one of the traps that you can fall into, I know I fell into it, is, you know, you see revocation as much a failure on your own part as the person that you're supervising. And, you know, revocation basically means we did everything we could. It didn't work. We feel like jail is the only option.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I talk about in the book a good bit is, you know, there were times when I felt like maybe I jumped the gun a little bit and I sent somebody back before I tried everything at my disposal. There were other times where maybe I waited too long and I let somebody kind of go too far down a path. You know, there were warning signs that I ignored. And I think one of the real struggles for POs is because you're taking it personally and because you see revocation as sort of a personal failure, you know, that can kind of push you in different directions. And sometimes they're to the offender's benefit, but sometimes not.
Now, this is work that, like any helping profession, exerts a great personal cost. And you write about that a lot. You write about what you thought about, how you felt. There's this really moving description when you describe what it's like the first time you put handcuffs on another person.
I think one of the things that I thought I was ready for that I wasn't was just the amount of authority and discretion that you get with this job.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's true of any law enforcement job, but, you know, if you're a police officer, for example, you know, you show up and you see someone's, whatever, committed a crime, you put the handcuffs on, you take them to jail. It's really a matter of observing an incident and then responding as the law prescribes. But something like this, it's much more holistic. You know, and a lot of times when you're putting handcuffs on somebody, you know, you're doing that not based on the one incident, but on this kind of totality of circumstances where you're making a judgment, you know, based on what I've seen the last 10 times I spoke to this person, what do I think is the right next step? And ultimately, there are checks on you. The parole board can overrule you in cases of parole and probation. The judge has the final say. But for the most part, the officer gets to decide. And that's a lot of authority to carry around. And when you exercise it well and you think you see a positive change, it's a wonderful feeling. But a lot of times you don't know in the moment whether you made the right choice.
Mm-hmm. So how did you know it was time to move on?
Well, I think I knew when I found myself taking the work too personally. And frankly, I found myself kind of out of patience. One of the running jokes I had with Charles, my office mate, was, you know, what do you really need to succeed in this job? And, you know, the kind of joke word was grace, you know, and that there's people kind of just have their limits as far as, especially with addiction, kind of how many times you can try the same thing mm-hmm. and fail and then come back, you know, and it's almost like you need a little nudge from a higher power to keep doing it. And I kind of just got to the point where I felt like I really wasn't able to deal with kind of the come down from not being able to help people as much as I wanted to. And one of the things that I wanted to do was stay involved in the justice system, but I just kind of wanted to find a new role.
How is your work different now?
Well, I think in most law enforcement jobs, as I said, going back to the police example, a lot of times it comes down to, you know, you look at the law and essentially you figure out who's violating the law and, you know, you bring a prosecution against them. And it's certainly not easy, but there's more of a sense of turning the page with this mm-hmm. kind of work. And, you know, with probation and parole work, you might have the same person in your life for 2 or 3 years. You might see him relapse 5 or 6 times. I wish I would have had the grace or whatever you need to do it long term, but I just feel like what I'm doing now, I'm better suited to, and it's kind of easier at the end of the day to kind of move on to the next case.
So when did you know this would be a book?
Not until they printed it, actually.
That hopeful moment.
right. It kind of started off just sort of as journaling, honestly. Kind of when I was starting to get a little burned out, I thought that if I wrote some of my experiences down just for myself, that would help me process them a little bit. When I left, so this would have been 2016, of course, the nation was kind of having an ongoing debate about law enforcement in general, prison. But I actually wasn't hearing a whole lot about probation and parole. And it's actually where most felony offenses wind up. Is probation and parole.
It's staggering, that number, when you really stop and think about it.
It is. It's a huge number. And I just think it needs to be a part of the discussion of kind of where we're going in the justice system. And one thing I hope comes across in the book is that I think it's a system that has tremendous promise, but frankly, it's all coming down to funding. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that if the New Orleans district is any indication, we have great people out here doing the job, but they just need more resources to really succeed.
We've been talking with Jason Hardy, whose new book is The Second Chance Club, Hardship and Hope After Prison. You can meet him at both the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, the first Lucky Bean poetry reading of the year takes place Monday, February 17th at 7:30 at 2800 Charters. It features poet Elizabeth Gross and is followed by an open mic. The New Orleans Public Library is sponsoring a Black History Month student poster design contest. All entries will be judged on creativity, artistic merit, and best representation of the 2020 Black History Month theme, African Americans, and the vote. Winning posters will be displayed at all 15 library locations. Copies of the posters will be given to winners and their schools. The deadline is Saturday, February 29th at 5, and to enter, pick up a form at any library. The New Orleans Public Library is also again hosting an adult writing contest for this year's Black History Month, and it's open to any and all writers in Orleans Parish. Poetry, stories, and essays on the theme of roots are welcome. The deadline for that is February 28th. Tulane University Special Collections announces a new exhibit, Where We Stand, Zines from New Orleans, on display now till April 3rd at Tulane University Special Collections. It's in the second floor gallery at 6801 Ferret, Joseph Merrick Jones Hall on Tulane's Uptown Campus. Hours are 10 to 5 Monday through Friday, free admission. And in Baton Rouge, the Louisiana Center for the Book in the State Library of Louisiana celebrates Black History Month with Gather at the River, a tribute to Ernest J. Gaines. That's Wednesday, February 19th from noon to 1:30 in the Seminar Center of the State Library of Louisiana. That's at 701 North 4th Street in Baton Rouge. This program celebrates the life and work of Ernest J. Gaines. It will be hosted by his close friend, Gaines Center board member and two-time Louisiana Poet Laureate Daryl Bourque. It will include Marcia Godet, professor of English Emerita and founder and board president of the Gaines Center at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, Shailon Woods, director of the Gaines Center, Louisiana State Senator Karen Carter Peterson, and Gaines' wife, Diane Gaines, among others. Major support for the Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for the Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org.